I got a degree in wildlife ecology, and my dad was still in the Senate when I got that degree. And in 1980, when, as he jokingly said, he lost his re-election campaign in 1980, he had an amazing sense of humor. He said he got an invitation that he couldn't refuse, meaning to leave the Senate. He was a funny guy.
Hello and welcome to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. I'm Dr. Kristen Lierley, and I'm here today because it's Earth Day week with Tia Nelson. She is an internationally recognized champion for environmental stewardship and conservation. And she also happens to be the daughter of Earth Day founder, Gaylord Nelson. Welcome, Tia.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I am so, first of all, I'm your dad's biggest fangirl. I've been to Clear Lake. I did that pilgrimage. I get it. I understand where it all came from, because Clear Lake is beautiful. It's northern Wisconsin. There's water. There are trees. Yes. But for you, this is the 56th Earth Day. You have grown up with Earth Day from the very beginning. What does this feel like for you?
Oh, well, thanks for your question. And you may honestly assert that you're his biggest fangirl, but you have to get in line behind me. he was such a great dad. And it's meaningful that you mention Clear Lake, because it, you know, when people would ask my father how he came to be so passionate and dedicate so much of his public service career to the environment, he always said it was, you know, by osmosis, you know, in nature imbued osmotically into him. A passion for the environment. And he used to tell this really funny story. He had his best friend in Clear Lake was a guy named Sherman Benson. And not far from Clear Lake is Mud Lake. And the turtles in the fall, the turtles in the fall from migrate from Clear Lake to Mud Lake because it's a more suitable winter habitat. And my father became intrigued as a very, very young boy by, you know, how did the turtles know where to go every year, right? And so he and Sherman, in the way that, you know, young mischievous boys can be, decided to try to confuse the turtles. So they picked them up and spun them around and hid them behind trees and put them in tall grass and thought they'd get lost. And indeed, you know, just like a honing pigeon, they just corrected their course and marched on to Mud Lake. It used to fascinate him. Clear Lake and growing up in nature was formative for my father. And for me today, when I, and for all these many years, I think I was 12 for the first Earth Day. We did a cleanup at the Rock Creek Park, which ran near my junior high school. We did a trash cleanup like a lot of young kids on the first Earth Day. And I had no idea at the time the significance of that day. And certainly it was successful beyond my father's wildest dreams. He was calling for a teach-in on the environment. He was inspired after going to inspect the oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara, at the time the largest oil spill in history. And he was flying home and he picked up a magazine out of the back seat of the airplane, a magazine that doesn't exist anymore called Ramparts Magazine. And the front page story was about how anti-war teach-ins on campuses were changing the narrative on the morality of the Vietnam War. And he'd been struggling for a long time to come up with an idea that would galvanize the people to demand a discussion about clean air and clean water. And it was an aha moment for him, and he decided to call for an environmental teach-in. And 20 million people gathered on that day, the largest gathering in history, and really something that was successful beyond his wildest dreams in the ensuing years for me. It's always a moment of reflection, and it is a particularly challenging time today. And for me, it's a complicated dance between hope and despair.
Yeah, it is such a challenging time. Hey, I was crushed last week when the Senate voted to take away restrictions against mining in the headwaters of the Boundary Waters. It just feels like one assault after another on our environment. And Earth Day feels more relevant and urgent than ever before in my lifetime. Do you see the same thing?
I do, and the thing that it puzzles me the in certain ways, though I have some thoughts about why the environment has become a divisive issue. Keep in mind, in 1970, the Senate adjourned. All members of Congress went back to their districts and did something. More environmental laws were passed in the decade that followed than any other time in history. A Republican president created the Environmental Protection Agency, Richard Nixon. He also signed into law the National Environmental Policy Act, which is relevant to the Boundary Waters issue. This was a law designed to ensure there was a science-based assessment of the impacts of development on the environment. And there's been broad bipartisan support for the environment for many years. I was in Rio de Janeiro at the Earth Summit in 1992. George Herbert Walker Bush signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change there. And he said, paraphrased by me, the United States will lead the world in addressing the crisis of climate change. And so, how have we gone from a place of bipartisan support for clean air and clean water, something that everyone needs regardless of their political beliefs or any other belief construct? And I have some theories about it. One in particular, which I've thought a lot about after a conversation with a Republican friend of mine, I think that the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, had a particularly pernicious effect on the making of sound public policy, because suddenly you're in a situation in which unlimited amounts of money can come from unidentified people to influence the outcome of elections. And it happens across the board. But we certainly are face extraordinary challenges, and the irony is the public supports clean air and clean water, supports our public lands and the protection of these special places. And so there's a big disconnect between what's happening politically and what the public supports, and that makes it particularly challenging.
This was the genius of Earth Day, though. For your dad to put those things together and say, I'm not getting anywhere in the Senate. I've talked to everybody. Nobody seems to care about this environmental stuff that seems so important to me and to all of us. But to figure out that taking it to the people was the way to get that groundswell, to get the leaders to pay attention, to get things passed, and then turn the 70s into this environmental decade was just extraordinary. And it feels like that's kind of where we're at right now, doesn't it?
Well, it's that's the hope part of what's in my heart every day, but especially in the days leading up to Earth Day. Individual action matters. And my father demonstrated that, think there are Greta Thunberg, the climate youth activist, she could not have imagined that her simple silent act of protest in front of the Swedish parliament would launch a global youth movement on climate change. She couldn't have foreseen that any more than my father could have seen the outcome of Earth Day, or that it's this enduring part of his legacy. He thought this was a one-time thing. Or you think of someone, Rosa Parks, whose refusal to move to the back of the bus in 1964, I think it was. The Civil Rights Act was adopted in 1964. She moved forward the civil rights movement in a significant way that she couldn't have possibly anticipated from her single act of principle and her individual action. And so I take these stories, my father's story, and the stories of other individuals who have acted from a place of principle and done something important to them, to use their voice to express concern. And they've changed history. And I that is always a source of inspiration and hope for me.
I think about what this means in our lives, what Earth Day and conservation and being environmentally responsible means for all of us. And for me as a doctor, sometimes we don't put these pieces together, but it affects our individual and community health. These are all of the things that go into environment are social determinants of our health: clean water, clean air, access to walkable neighborhoods with green space. It's good for our mental and physical health. And I think about a quote that your father shared as he was doing not just Earth Day work, but the Appalachian Trail and banning DDT and all of this other stuff that he was involved with. He said an environment, he said the goal wasn't just clean air and water, but an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all other human beings and all living creatures. And that reflects to me such a holistic view of why this isn't tree huggers or just one isolated thing, but how knit together it all is and has such a huge impact on our health, our lives, our economy, really all of it, Tia.
Yes, the I love that quote that you evoked of my father's. I found there were various versions of that speech that he gave on the first Earth Day. He appeared in public dozens of times. I've seen his schedule; it was crazy busy. But in one of the versions, he goes on after the quote that you used to say that ecology is a big science, not a narrow science. He goes on to reference public housing unworthy of its name and the poor in Appalachia. He painted a really broad view of what it meant to have a clean environment. and it includes people and our quality of life writ large across the country. My personal view is the environmental community did not respond initially to the more holistic framing of his message on the first Earth Day. It took some time before we talked about urban environments and health outcomes in poorer communities as a part of the concept of protecting nature. And I've worked for a long time on climate change education, and I used to get in debates with friends who were very focused on talking about the science. And my concern at the time was we were talking about the science in a way that was not easily understandable by someone who's not immersed in the issue day to day. And we use our own language and our own acronyms, and it's not we weren't necessarily the best communicators on some of these issues. And one of the arguments I made, and I think of it because of your service as a doctor, I said, you know, I don't need to convince. I don't need to teach the mother of a child with asthma climate change science 101. What she needs to understand, what would help her, is understanding that the coal plant down the street is spewing pollution that is causing the asthma attack that is not letting her kid go to school today because they're too sick. And these are broadly impactful issues on quality of life. There was another quote of my father's, in which he said, our prosperity, our economic well-being is dependent on our natural resource base. And one of his quotes was, "The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment, not the other way around." And by that, he meant that we cannot economically prosper without productive soils, clean water, and clean air. And so everything we do is dependent on the protection of these things, which represent our quality of life.
You yourself are incredibly accomplished on many different levels. How do you think growing up in this household has set you on the path to where you are right now? And how much of that was deliberate, you thinking this is what I love to do? Nature versus nurture, Tia. How'd you get here?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. By now, I should have a tidy answer. I can tell you that I spent a lot of time in nature with my parents and my friends. I was naturally attracted to that. I loved animals, so I thought I wanted to be a veterinarian when I grew up. But then I came to find out that that's requires you it's and you have to be a doctor, and that seemed too daunting for me. I have pretty severe dyslexia, so academia is always hard for me. I struggled in school. It was a miserable place for me to be. I was undiagnosed and couldn't figure out why things that were easy for others were so hard for me in a classroom setting. So I abandoned my idea of becoming a doctor of animals, and I got a degree in wildlife ecology. And my dad was still in the Senate when I got that degree. And in 1980, when, as he jokingly said, he lost his re-election campaign in 1980. He had an amazing sense of humor. He said he got an invitation that he couldn't refuse, meaning to leave the Senate. He was he He could really, he was a funny guy. So he went to the Wilderness Society. He could have hung out a shingle and made a lot of money, been a consultant and gone to, a K Street firm in Washington, but he wanted to continue his passion on the environment. So he went to become a president at the Wilderness Society. And so I jokingly accused him of following in my footsteps because by then I had a wildlife ecology degree and I was pursuing my environmental career. I worked in the field a little bit for the Department of Natural Resources. I worked up in Bayfield in the Apostle Islands as a fisheries technician. That's for me one of the, that's the, just one of the most magical places in the world for me, and is National Lakeshore. And the Republican President George W. Bush created the Gaylord Nelson Wilderness Area. The only wilderness area created under the Bush II administration is named after my father, and it's 19 of the 21 Apostle Islands. I go there every summer solstice, which happens to be my birthday as well, but anyway, I served as a fisheries technician for the DNR, so I was a field ecologist collecting data on fish so we could properly manage the fish population there, and ended up in California doing some of that work as well. And it just, I realized that without an advanced degree, I wasn't going to be particularly impactful. And the truth is, I'm not a great scientist. So I pivoted to the working on the public policy side. And I returned to Wisconsin. I worked in the Capitol in the legislature for the Natural Resources Committee, where I learned how a bill became a law, where I learned what we were doing to protect our groundwater and our air quality and our parks and protected areas. And then I thrived in that environment, keeping in mind that I was so close with my father at a very, very young age. I would beg him to let me go to work with him. So walking the halls of Congress was something that I was quite practiced at from early age. I think I started, around when I was 10, and I'd just follow him around and do whatever he was doing and asking him questions and so on. So I was very comfortable in that space, and I left my work in state government in Wisconsin to work in policy, environmental policy, for the Nature Conservancy, and eventually became the director of their climate change program, and traveled the world working on the intersection of the issue of land protection and climate change. And they're critically linked, less talked about than the renewable energy side, but equally important. So I, it just happened is the, I guess I gave you the long answer. If anybody followed the thread, congratulations. The short answer is I love, it was just my path. I don't recall ever, there was no pivotal moment in my life. No, it's the way my life unfolded, which I think is true for a lot of us.
It's a journey, not a
It's, yeah, it's a
destination.
journey, not a destination, you bet.
And I do believe you are about to get your doctoral degree. The UW-Madison is going to give you an honorary doctorate. Talk about
Well, once I got over the shock,
that.
well, I'll tell you what I put on my LinkedIn post, which will be the basis of my remarks. It's such a distinguished honor, and I was shocked. I had no idea that that was going to happen. And of course, I feel a great sense of honor. There's moments in which I feel candidly, there are moments when I feel unworthy, but what I put in my LinkedIn post was the following, that I asked my father once why he was receiving an award, and he responded to me, "Never question the judgment of the awards committee when you're the recipient." So that's where I start. I then went, you know, go on to applaud those who got their doctorate degree the hard way, like you and many others. Because I think it's important to talk about, especially for those of us who learn differently, went on to say, for those of you who struggled academically as I did, for those of you who may suffer from dyslexia, know that with the right community support, you can do good things. Everything the chancellor writes in that article about me and as regards the awarding of the doctorate, I accomplished because of a teammate, teammates, mentors, compatriots. I wouldn't have accomplished any of those things without the support and help of people around me. And one of the things I've gotten really good at, and I get better the older I get, is, you know, asking for help, saying I don't know, reaching out to people whose judgment I trust and asking them to help me figure it out. So in the LinkedIn post, I make sure to thank all of those who lifted me up and supported me and helped me accomplish those things. And it's a great honor and a big surprise. And it'll be the first time I've actually put a gown on. I was such a defiant young person. I skipped graduation when I was younger. So
I did too.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah. It just didn't mean anything to me. The ceremonial thing.
I
got my degree.
Yeah. The chancellor's office, you know, asked me who I want there. And I'm like, these are my friends. I don't want to make them suffer for hours through pomp and circumstance. I probably shouldn't say that, but my partner will join me. Oh, the other thing is I flunked in college. I flunked first year of chemistry, and that was a 5-credit F. So it dramatically impacted my ability to graduate from college. I had enough credits, but my grade point was so low, I had to continue until I got my grade point up. Well, my chemistry professor, Dr. Bassam Shakashiri, a renowned scientist and one of the best teachers I've ever known, and a man who brings such passion to the teaching of science to young people. He is my guest. He will be sitting with my partner, and I'm going to recognize him and tell everyone, reassure them that you can flunk college chemistry and go on to do good things in life. So Bassam will be my foil. My partner will be there. And another friend of mine volunteered, and I said, okay, if you want to sit through that, I would love to have you there.
Oh, it's going to be such a celebration. Yeah. And, you know, I am not at all surprised that you are connected with Dr. Shakashiri. And anybody who watches Wisconsin Public Television or has been paying attention for the past few decades, this is a guy who makes science fun. He takes complicated scientific information and turns it into something that we want to pay attention to and we understand. And you've been doing that in the climate space. And I do it in the medical space because we know that these things can't live in their bubbles.
Yes.
We have to get this information out to the general public. We're back to grassroots. We're back to regular people.
Yes.
And bringing everybody together because this really is, it continues to be a giant movement that touches every part of our lives.
Yeah. Indeed, indeed.
Yeah. So what do you want somebody who's never thought about conservation? There are plenty of people out there who are just living their lives. They're not thinking about it. But I think now people are starting to get a sense that, you know, weather has changed. We had a blizzard up here a few weeks ago. Then we had a nice storm. Now we've got flooding, tornadoes. It's been crazy. People are feeling it in the way they haven't before. What do you want people to feel about conservation, people who haven't been thinking and feeling it.
I want everyone to know there's something they can do, that individual action matters. And whether you're planting a pollinator, little pollinator garden in your backyard, or composting your food waste, or writing your elected officials, being sure that you're informed on the environmental positions of those running for office, and be sure you're using your voice by voting, joining community organizations. There's a fabulous land trust movement in Wisconsin. There's a land trust in every community across this state, from small to large. You can volunteer with the land trust. What you can do, something. And the important thing is we all do something, that we talk about it and that we engage in a way that's meaningful to us. And that can look differently for you and me than from our neighbors. But everyone deserves the right to breathe clean air and to drink clean water. We all have to engage in a way that's meaningful to us to keep these issues in the forefront, and to demand of our elected officials that they lead with sound science, informing sound public policy to protect every citizen's right to a clean environment. Because it is all of our rights, and we all have a chance, an opportunity, and I would argue an obligation, to do something.
Every single one of us can do something that is meaningful to us.
Yeah.
And that is,
you know,
such a perfect message.
The, here's a fact that I like to share that surprised me as I was doing some of my climate work. In the world of climate change, we think a lot about greenhouse gas emissions from the industrial sector, oil and gas, coal. We often don't recognize that land use plays a significant role in that. You know, forests are sequestering carbon dioxide, respiring oxygen through the process of photosynthesis. So protecting and restoring forests is a climate solution. But here's something that comes right into our homes that most people don't recognize. If food waste were a country, it would be the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions after the US and China. Mm-hmm. And it happens for different reasons, depending upon where you are. We throw away a significant percentage of food grown in the United States is wasted or tossed. In the developing world, the challenge is different. It's more around storage, available proper storage and transportation. But reducing food waste in your home is not a sacrifice. It's going to save you in your wallet. And it contributes significantly to climate change. I have a vegetable garden, which I just, that's a happy place for me to grow my own food, even if it's a lot of investment of time, but it brings me great joy and keeps me close to the earth. So I compost my food waste, but as conscientious as I am about that issue, knowing what I know, I'm still challenged to sort of manage the food in my fridge. But I'm wasting, when I'm creating food waste, I'm also wasting money, and I'm also contributing to climate change. So that, I mean, that's just such an easy, like, no-brainer, everybody can do it. Reduce your food waste. It's a big source of greenhouse gas emissions, and it'll save you money. So that's a simple and surprising climate solution. But the key is to keep in mind that all of our actions impact the environment, and we all have the opportunity to reduce our impact in our day-to-day lives, and then also through our engagement in community and politics.
You're so right. And I am excited to hear you say this about food waste, because I will tell you, I have transformed my life in the last year, because we've got a compost service up here in the Green Bay area, but there are lots of others around the state where I just have a bucket and I just put our food waste into the bucket. And it's kind of become a game at our house where we try to be thoughtful about what we buy. We save money there and we try to make sure that we're eating the things that are going to go bad. You know, sometimes you like ignore those carrots in the bottom of your refrigerator, eat them. And it has really changed how we approach food. We're much smarter consumers now, because we were trying to do the right environmental thing. It's fun.
Yeah, it is. Well, you take those limp carrots and throw them in the freezer, and then make your chicken or beef stock or vegetable stock out of them. So there's a use for them. I'm looking up at my computer and seeing that my battery is low. I thought it was fully charged. Do you want me? I have a cord around the corner. I don't
you know,
know how
we,
much more time you want.
I have one more question for you.
Okay.
Okay. If your father could see Earth Day 2026, what do you think he would be most proud of, and what do you think he'd be most disappointed in?
Well, I certainly he'd be most proud of the fact that today Earth Day is celebrated in nearly 200 countries, celebrated around the world. It's an enduring event in which communities engage to talk about and act on critical environmental issues, and that would delight him to know. And on the other side of the coin, I think he obviously would be concerned and saddened by the turn back of environmental protections, but perhaps the thing that would most concern him is the diminished government resources dedicated to science, because at the end of the day, you can't make sound public policy without sound science, and the fact that science has somehow become politicized in a way that is new and threatens our ability to find the truth and make the right decisions.
Yeah, I worry about that too. But I think we can get it back,
yeah,
and we do it by working
absolutely.
together.
It used to be a bipartisan issue. I believe it can be again, but not without all of us using our voice and getting involved.
That's right. Go team.
Yeah.
Tia, thank you so much for taking the time to join me this morning to have this conversation, and for all of the incredible work that you have done and how you continue to carry the torch for your wonderful dad, who I'll get in line behind you.
Okay.
Fangirl.
The pleasure was mine. I so appreciate you, your efforts, and I'm grateful for the chance to talk to you and so delighted you were interested in having this conversation and helping get the word out on Earth Day. I'm grateful.
We'll keep it going, sister.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Tia Nelson, internationally recognized champion for environmental stewardship and conservation. If you enjoyed our conversation, please like, share, subscribe, hit that bell so you'll know when the next episode comes up. Thank you for joining us today. See you later.